Hello and welcome to the Random Walks podcast. Today I have Dr. Amy Zhang, who is the director of the Social Futures Lab at the University of Washington's Allen School of Computer Science and Engineering, where she also serves as an assistant professor. Prior to that, Dr. Zhang received a PhD from MIT's Computer Science and Artificial Intelligence Laboratory, where her PhD thesis received the Best Thesis Award at MIT in Computer Science. And during her PhD, she was also an affiliate and a fellow at the Berkman Klein Center at Harvard University, a Google PhD fellow and an NSF graduate research fellow. Prior to that, Dr. Zhang earned her a master's in computer science at the University of Cambridge on a Gates Fellowship and a BS in computer science at Rutgers University, where she also captained the women's tennis team. Before joining the University of Washington, Dr. Zhang served as a postdoctoral researcher at Stanford's computer science department. And last year, she started her own laboratory at the University of Washington. Welcome, Dr. Zhang.
Thanks for having me.
So, Amy, you have had a very phenomenal career path across many top institutions and all, along with doing some very fantastic research and all. So, was research, academia, science, and computing as a whole something on your minds when you were getting started? Were there any early influences in your life, in your family, or were there any class that you took that piqued your interest in science and that led you to blaze this phenomenal trail that you have?
Thank you. That's very kind. So I think I, from an early age, did not really think of myself as an academic or a scientist at all. I knew when I was young that I did not want to be a doctor, did not want to be a lawyer, didn't really know what I wanted to do. My father is a network engineer for his work. So I was exposed to computers and, technology in our home from a young age. So I think that was potentially a catalyst for me getting involved in computer science. Although I remember he tried to get me to read some like networking books from like Cisco when I was a child, did not enjoy it. And it wasn't until high school when I took my high school's AP computer science classes, my junior and senior year of high school, that I found that I really enjoyed computer science. I enjoyed sort of like the puzzle aspect of it. I enjoyed the creativity and the kind of fun that you get in creating things that you get from programming. So I knew, I think from kind of that point on in high school that I really enjoyed computer science. There was also, there was sort of like a very small cohort of fellow girls in my computer science class, particularly in senior year of high school. I was part of this like three-person all-girl competitive programming team in my high school. And we went to several kind of regional programming competitions together, which having that kind of like community of friendship also, I think, made me feel that the stuff that I was doing, like that it was something that I could do, that the space was welcoming for me. So I became involved in initiatives like, women in computer science when I went to college, and I majored in computer science, kind of building on that experience in high school. However, in college, up until this point, I had never really thought about research, academia being something that was for me. I took kind of like regular software engineering internships, interviewed for kind of your typical software engineering jobs in college, thought that that was my future. I did one kind of research project in my junior year, kind of just because it was, related to my honors program that I was in. It seemed like something that I should do. I did it. It was in sort of like a vision lab. Did not really enjoy the research. So it kind of solidified that, oh, research is not for me. It wasn't until my senior year. There was actually a professor, not in the computer science department, but in the kind of information school at my university, who just by happenstance found out that I was this kind of like undergrad doing computer science and reached out to me to join his research group, which at the time was focused on social computing, this topic that I did not know existed. I did not know that people did this for research. And so I didn't know this existed. It wasn't really and human computer interaction in general was not a huge aspect of my computer science undergraduate curriculum. So him reaching out to me kind of opened me to this area of research that I did not know about that I really loved. And it was really that topic and interest in that topic that then led me to, you know, apply to grad school, go to grad school, and decide to continue on to research.
That's a really wonderful elucidation on the phenomenal trail that you took. In between, you also mentioned about having a flair for competitive programming in high school, where with a group of senior girls, you sort of formed a group and all. So did that carry over into your undergraduate days also? Did you have any chance to take part in the way the intercollegiate programming championships, the famous ICPCs or something of that sort?
Yeah, no, I didn't really. I think... first of all, I enjoyed competitive programming, but I wasn't very good at it. So I was not like a winner in any of these things. It was fun. When I got to college also, I was on the tennis team at college. So I also played competitive tennis in high school and then in college. And that ended up taking quite a lot of my time. So really for the first several years of college, I was just kind of taking classes and playing tennis, and that was mostly my life. And it wasn't, until near the end of my, really, really at the end of my college career that I started to be like, there's this thing called research and maybe I should do more of that.
That's really wonderful. And so was it a conscious decision to apply to MIT as such, or did you apply to all the top computer science departments? And from where the offers came, the department at MIT suited your research interests the best? And were you always set on pursuing social computing, human computer interaction for your grad school too? Or were you open to exploring any other areas?
So I was pretty set on that topic. I had a great experience doing that my senior year of college. From that experience, did a summer internship, spending some time at Yahoo Research. I then did my master's in Cambridge on a similar topic, looking at social media data and sort of what we can learn from it. And to be honest, I didn't really focus on human-computer interaction specifically until my PhD. So I just wasn't as like aware of kind of this like longstanding tradition of like work at the intersection of computer science, like human factors, psychology, sociology, and these other social sciences. I was more narrowly working in the space of like computational social science up until I became aware of HCI. So in a sense, there was a bit of a shift from the research I was doing before my PhD to the research I was doing during my PhD. But probably from someone on the outside looking in, they're not seeing a huge difference. It's all kind of related to social computing. I would say, as to picking MIT. So yeah, obviously, MIT is a fantastic place, and I feel lucky to have gone there. At the time, however, it was actually more of a personal reason. So my boyfriend at the time was and we had met in Cambridge, the University of Cambridge, and he went on to do a PhD at Harvard. And then I started a software engineering job actually in New York for a year. And it was during that year that I applied for PhD programs, and specifically wanted to target MIT and the universities kind of around Boston so that I could stay in Boston and live with my boyfriend. So that was the major important reason. But of course, also fantastic program and found a great advisor and did the research that I wanted to do. So all those things kind of lined up.
That's really great. And when it came to choosing your advisor, were you fixated on working with someone specific to your area of interest? As you said, you were already pretty sure of pursuing social computing. So was there any advisor that you had picked out beforehand, or did you rotate on a couple of labs and all before you sort of came to picking your eventual advisor?
So it was pretty much kind of decided from the outset, because at the time, HCI was not that prevalent at MIT as well. So there were really only like two or three faculty within the computer science department at MIT that did research in human-computer interaction, particularly the human-computer interaction that I wanted to do in social computing. There really was just one person. And so it was kind of like a done deal kind of when I was visiting at that point, kind of who I'd be working with. I mean, there were two people that I kind of spent time, a little bit of time in one person's lab, and then went and sat with the other person for a little while. But I kind of only really had one advisor during my entire PhD.
And in your grad school, did you also suffer from the ubiquitous imposter syndrome? And even after you graduated out, as I mentioned earlier on, you have been at the top places and all. And many who have come on RandomWorks say the imposter syndrome never leaves you, especially in academia and I mean many other settings also too. So did you face the ubiquitous imposter syndrome, and how did you sort of overcome it and get around it?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think that being in a place like MIT and these other institutions, you're definitely surrounded by smart people. I think what was, I don't know, like, I think, you know, what I wasn't particular, I don't know, how should I say this? It was definitely intimidating being around other smart people, but I guess I just didn't really let it get to me that much, because I felt like we were all different, or at least that like they other people were very smart, but I didn't feel like their smartness threatened me, I guess. Like I was excited about the work I was doing, and I felt like I, you know, was able to kind of make consistent progress on it. And other people were doing exciting work as well, but it was different from the work that I was doing. And it didn't feel to me like it was a competitive place, although I know that other people have described places like MIT as a competitive place. But really for me, I did not have that feeling while I was there. And partly that might have been just kind of the culture in the lab that I was in. I feel like my lab was extremely welcoming, extremely supportive. I think we had a fantastic lab culture. And perhaps that's why I feel a little bit insulated from this like feeling of threat, or also in some cases stereotype threat. I'll say that our lab was majority women. So I felt like I had a really supportive environment. I also think reflecting on my experience, my experience also as kind of like a competitive tennis player leading up to my PhD helped me in a way to not be as sort of bogged down by the, you know, what others might describe as a competitive atmosphere. Again, like I didn't really feel like I noticed that as much. In that, you know, as a tennis player, as an athlete in general, like you kind of have to face losses all the time, right? If you're competing at a level where it's interesting for you, then that means that you're losing, you know, a good amount of the time. And, you know, tennis is just like another sport where like you kind of know where you sit, and you, you know, you're going to be able to have some wins against folks, but you'll also lose a lot of the time. And kind of getting used to that and being okay with not being the best all the time, I think was something that I did feel used to because of my experience in athletics. So in my PhD, you know, dealing with paper rejections, dealing with criticism, I don't know, I didn't let it sort of get me down. So I think that might have some reason to do with it.
That's a really terrific elucidation on not getting bogged down by rejections. And academia, as we all know, is plentiful of rejections. There are rejections from the Ubiquitous Reviewer too, and then there are rejections from multiple conference venues and all that we face. But as you said, sports, athletics, tennis in your case, really teaches you to not get bogged down and continue on. And so in all this, how important have mentors been to you in your whole incredible journey that you have traversed? And are there any fond anecdotes that you'd like to tell us about?
Yeah, absolutely. So I had alluded to earlier sort of a person who reached out to me in my senior year of college that really introduced me to research. This is a professor at Rutgers. He's now a professor at Cornell Tech. His name is Moore Nauman. And, I think he has been an amazing mentor for me throughout my career. And particularly, I think, introducing me to research at that age, because I think without that sort of intervention, I would not have been on the path that I'm currently on. And it was really like something that he did. It wasn't an initiative that I took to speak to him or to go searching for potential undergraduate advisors or research areas. Like he actually did the legwork and found me. Amazingly, I don't know how exactly he picked me out, but having someone like that, I think, was incredibly, lucky for me to have at that age. In addition to him, I think, all of the advisors that I have, my master's advisor, the PhD students I worked with in Cambridge, in addition, my PhD advisor at MIT, and the older PhD students in my lab were all extremely instrumental in cultivating my curiosity, my research taste, my research skills, just all around like extremely helpful for me in my career.
That's truly wonderful. And something that I'd like to ask you about, in between your phenomenal career path in academia, you have also sort of interned and worked at industrial academic labs and all in between. So having experienced an industrial culture of sorts at Google, Microsoft and elsewhere and all, so what role do you see industry playing as society and technology moves forward, especially in computing? Because as one realizes, whenever there is loads of money involved and all, very few institutions can sort of hope to compete with the economic prowess that industrial labs by the big tech companies and all hold. And as we see in recent times, there has been a lot of issues cropping up and all, especially with respect to the way industry treats ethics and all, issues of ethics and all, something that's directly relevant to your work and all. So what role do you see industry playing and all, and how important do you feel regulation is with respect to regulating the role that industry plays? Do you see with their money prowess, them playing an outsized role and all, and is there a need to cut back and sort of regulate the way they function and all?
I think for the most part, the industry groups, the industry positions that I was in were research internships, and they were in research divisions of industry. So I don't really feel like I have a good sense of industry, if that makes sense. So like places I went, like Microsoft Research, are relatively insulated from the product side and important aspects of the company in Microsoft, in terms of like actually like being in the pathway of product and profit. And in particular, like places like Microsoft Research, like they, in many ways, they operate kind of more similarly to an academic lab than kind of like a product team within a company. So I can't say that it was that different, to be honest. Like, especially I think, the way that they treat research interns and the projects that they give research interns, you really do feel kind of like you're in a research lab. You're quite insulated from other aspects of the company. I really felt like in my summer internships, I had the freedom to work on sort of research topics that interested me that, you know, may have had nothing to do with the company that I was in. And that my main goal was to kind of do research and publish a paper at the end of my summer internship. That experience is a little different in some other places. The only other place I've really interned is Google. And in that case, there was a similarly like academic feeling there. It was slightly closer tied to product in that we were having conversations with product teams to understand how the research we were doing could be relevant to their product. Again, the internships that I did span from like 2014 to 2018, I think. And in some ways, I think the two places that I interned at, Microsoft and Google, have changed in some ways since then. So it's hard for me to say how they are today.
Those are some really prescient points you made. And coming back to your research in the field of human-computer interaction and social computing, do you mind giving us a primer on the work that you have been doing, you have already done and all, especially in your graduate school and postdoctoral days, and the questions that you're seeking to answer in your lab that you recently started and all? And could you also sort of elucidate a bit on what those two fields especially entail within modern science and modern computing science?
Yeah, so social computing and HCI are two rather broad topics. I'll describe them. So social computing is the study of technology in service of human-human social interaction, right? So a lot of the social computing work that I focus on is via the internet and software. There are other people that work on social computing in offline settings using like hardware devices and you know, things like VR, et cetera. But I really focus on VR and AR, but I really focus on kind of internet technologies such as, you know, Zoom, Slack, Facebook, Twitter, et cetera, email, all these different ways that people have communications and form community online. And thinking about how to design those systems and build them in such a way to foster, you know, positive social interactions and pro-social outcomes and, overall societal good. So thinking about things like combating online harassment that people are facing in these online social settings, thinking about information quality that we access in online social settings and in combating issues like misinformation that spread through online social media, thinking about how to make our platforms online more democratic and responsive to people's needs, thinking about how we use social media in civic life, and how our social technologies can be beneficial to our public institutions like local government, local news, et cetera. So all these things are things that my new lab at UW focuses on. And in particular, the aspect of social computing that I focus on is this point of design, which I design and building of social systems, which is kind of an aspect of HCI, human-computer interaction, which is even more broadly related to this topic of the interaction between people and technology quite broadly. So that encompasses a lot of things, encompasses everything from all the social things I just mentioned to input devices, output devices, information visualization, wearables, IoT, et cetera. So lots and lots of things. My piece of that in combining social computing and HCI is that I think about design, I think about the building of technology, and I think about that in this social context. So that's what I would say is the focus of my lab.
That's a really phenomenal elucidation. And the work that you have been doing, especially with respect to sort of designing and building systems or resilient systems and all with respect to sort of the way discourse works and online media settings, social media settings and all. That's really relevant. And especially in the last decade, especially in the last half of the last decade, it really sort of, in a world where the world entered a phase of a post-truth world where alternative facts rule the roost and all, your work comes into even more prominence and all. So how do you see the field evolving and all? Of course, the work that you do is very important and its importance is going to increase day by day as misinformation is widespread. And as we see, there is a emotional, social, and a physical cause that misinformation has, especially during pandemic times, as we see when sort of wrong guidances or when people at the very top sort of emphasize on wrong science and something of that sort. So how do you see the field evolving and sort of to meet the challenges that plague the world at large?
Yeah, I mean, I think that misinformation is not a new problem, right? It, you know, even in the days before the internet, there have been issues with information that is spread that is not credible through word of mouth or through various types of publications. I think today, however, with the internet, we have some differences, right? So we have these an explosion of the kinds of sources in which people can access information. In addition, much of the information that we access is now through social means. So via these social media platforms or also via search engines. Particularly in the online information landscape, a lot of times when we receive that information, it is in a context where it may be difficult to determine the validity of that information. So if you are someone who, receives a link from a friend via a WhatsApp, you know, message or a Facebook group that you're in, perhaps you're not really noticing the source of the link that you've been sent because it's sent by a trusted friend. And you click in and you read the content without really thinking too much about checking the credibility of the source, checking the journalist, author, et cetera, et cetera. So I think there are things that we can do to better design these systems to get people to think about these things in the moment, and also to be able to kind of quickly grasp differences in information credibility in these kind of undifferentiated feed-like spaces. So that is part of my work in trying to kind of reintroduce these ideas of like credibility signals back into the places where we're encountering information. I think that there is also a lot of other interesting work that people are doing to improve the information kind of credibility landscape online, from, you know, education and training to help support people who are encountering this information to better determine the differences, as well as tools to on the technologist side, thinking through these questions of design and also questions of like being able to check and moderate for this kind of content. So I think all of that is important. But yeah, I'm really interested in sort of the design piece and giving users more understanding and more power to be able to determine that kind of information.
That's a really fantastic overview that you gave of the field and the pressing challenges. And as you mentioned, WhatsApp is a communication medium that's extensively used in South Asia and India especially. And there have been loads of cases and incidents where sort of messages go viral and all. And that has led to social incidents, that has led to lynchings and all because of unfounded rumors and all. And as we spoke about earlier, in the pandemic times, there was a human cost associated with the rampant misinformation that's peddled through WhatsApp. And this is something that happens across the world through numerous other platforms. And the work that you have been doing really sort of brings it into prominence and underscores the need to sort of address these issues, educate the users better and all, because as you recently mentioned, the very essence of these social media networks is to sort of generate content and sort of keep people engrossed and all, but at times the social impact is lost, and the work that you do is really important in that context.
Thank you. That's very kind.
So coming to this, so as you spoke about a bit earlier too, about stereotypes and all, so academia and has been no different compared to other parts of the human enterprise. And there have been too long issues like gender disparity, bias and discrimination against underrepresented groups that have plagued academia too. So were you on the receiving end at any point of time, or was there any mentee of yours that was at the receiving end, and did you have to confront it either on your behalf or someone else's behalf? And once you became a graduate student, postdoc, and a professor currently, so how did you tackle this once you donned these multiple different hats with some more power than a graduate student or something of that sort?
Mm-hmm. I think inclusivity is incredibly important. I think it's incredibly important for our field, and that is something that all people in leadership positions in academia should be working to improve. I will say that personally, I haven't had major incidents of discrimination, at least that I'm aware of, in my experiences with people. I've, as I've kind of mentioned before, I had women mentors and women colleagues, women peers from high school in my kind of all-girl programming group to college, where I had a leadership role in our Women in CS club and was sort of active in the CS community in college, onwards to my master's in Cambridge, where I was advised by a wonderful woman professor, to my PhD program at MIT, where my lab was predominantly female. I think at some point it was like 100% female. So I just feel like I have had the mentorship and have had sort of, at least in terms of gender, like the gender representation that I've always felt sort of supported. And I know that that's not the case for everyone, and I want it to be the case for everyone. So it's been very important to me in my my role as a professor, teaching classes, starting a lab to, highlight the importance of inclusivity. So speaking about topics like bias and how technology can reinforce bias in the classes that I teach in human computer interaction at UW, as well as in my research. So my work on designing against issues like online harassment, which often has a gendered component, has been really important to me as well. And then also in my lab, making sure that we have a diversity of people in the lab, and making sure that these kinds of minor and major issues, but the things that we experience every day, like microaggressions, that these things are something that people don't have to experience, at least in my lab, to the best ability that I can, to sort of like set those norms, at least in the small communities that I'm in. I still think that there's plenty of work to be done though. So yeah, the work's not over.
Those are some absolutely fantastic points you made. And the very last point that you made was a very pertinent one, because even as we see currently, there have been top awards that have been in many fields that have been doled out to people who have had a long history of discriminatory views and all. And especially this year's Turing Award brought it into prominence, where one of the awardees has a known track record of making xenophobic comments against Iranian students and people from Iran, and as well as hold very obnoxious views on Native Americans and even Indians and Pakistanis and all. So it's really important to sort of highlight and espouse diversity and inclusion. And a point that many misses, like contrary to popular opinion, then diversity and inclusion of underrepresented groups only bolsters the field, rather than there is a trend of some meritocracy proponents of merit being diluted. But it's found too often than not, people from underrepresented groups tend to be overqualified compared to the general applicant pool and all, especially due to the long history of bias and discrimination that has plagued them and the groups and all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I have many Iranian colleagues that I would consider friends, including people in my lab, and I have personally seen like hardships that they have faced for being Iranian, such as having to have their visa denied so that they have to wait before they can come back into the country and continue their PhD work, being unable to go home to their country to, you know, see their relatives, attend weddings, funerals, etc. And these hardships can have a really hard toll. I think people who, aren't immigrants or who aren't from countries where there are sort of difficult challenges with these things like visas, don't realize how much of a drain it can be on someone's sort of mental energy and emotional resilience when your family is far away and you can't see them, and when you feel like your mobility is limited, like your ability to travel internationally for conferences and such is limited. This can have a real toll on your research productivity as well as your ability to make connections with other people, your ability to do research internships, your ability to travel for conferences, all of that is affected. And so, that people can, with those hardships in place, can still sort of achieve the same level of productivity, achieve the same level of research impact, does involve in many times doing more work and kind of having to develop greater resilience than people who don't have to face these kinds of very explicit barriers. I think that, these are real problems that not all of them come from, the academic community or from our specific research communities. They're kind of aspects of life today in the countries that we live in. However, there are things that our communities can do to alleviate and acknowledge some of the burdens and barriers that people face.
Absolutely. Those are some really great points you made. And people from the supposedly third world countries or underdeveloped countries can really relate to that point of sort of being denied visas and having to cross multiple barriers and then not going be able to travel frequently back to your family or even travel per se, because there's a whole lot of uncertainty that plagues your visas and all. And then there's a whole issue, even when, as we saw last year, even with conferences and seminars, workshops shifting online, the Neuromatch Academy experience was a really enlightening one, where a very famous neuroscience course went online, but still Iranian students were initially banned from attending it due to the way the sanctions programs work and all, and was eventually worked out. But it really brings into prominence the hurdles and loops that many people have to cross through. And a really great point that you made early on was also about sort of using your own position to sort of create a very diverse and inclusive culture and help create a safe space for all. Because as we see, especially in social media settings, in a recent episode and so in that transpired, where a Nobel laureate sort of went out to harass a pioneering researcher, a graduate student in HCI at MIT and all. And it's really important to use the bully pulpit that positions tend to award or honors tend to award to advocate for a more diverse and inclusive academia, rather than something where our own biases and all still creep in and all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree.
So coming to that, so you have been you talked about the role tennis has played in sort of helping you overcome barriers and all. So how did this interest in tennis develop as such? And were there any childhood inspirations or were there any games or slams that you watched on television that inspired you to pick up tennis and all? And how long did your journey with competitive tennis sort of last and all? And do you still follow tennis and all? And do you have any favorites?
I started playing tennis at the age of 5, and I don't think that there was a particular spark, or I don't even know, maybe I was just too young to recall now, but ever since I was just a very, very young age, I played tennis. So starting at the age of 5, I was sort of playing, I think at first for fun, but very quickly it became kind of a regular thing. And I was living in California at the time. At around age 7, I think I started to play my first competitive tennis tournaments in the local kind of California area, played competitively in California until I moved to Texas. When in Texas, I stopped playing competitively for a little while and then joined my high school tennis team, at which point I started to play competitively again. And this time became pretty serious. Like, I was traveling with my parents all over Texas, playing tennis. When it came time for college, played in some national competitions where there were college tennis coaches there. And that's when I kind of signed to Rutgers to play competitively for Rutgers. So I don't know. Tennis has been just a very integral part of my life. Just since a young age, has just always been with me up until after, I did also then play tennis at University of Cambridge for the Cambridge varsity team. So until basically I was 23, I had played, I want to say almost every day since the age of 5. So it was just a really everyday part of my life. Once that was over, I kind of stopped playing competitively. Went to MIT, and I was more of like a volunteer coach for the MIT team. So occasionally, and it was around this time that my tennis playing like really dropped off, just became a lot more focused on my PhD research and doing other hobbies. So I didn't play tennis as much, but occasionally did play with the MIT team. And since then, it's just gotten worse. So I've barely been able to play tennis at all in the last several years. I would really like to pick it back up. I think the opportunity just hasn't arisen, just between traveling and work and other things taking up my time. However, once the pandemic is over and I'm, settled in Seattle, I think it would be really great to start picking it up again.
That's really great. And do you have any favorite players or role models that you have been inspired by and all? And do you still, as you said, your hectic schedule doesn't allow you to play tennis, but do you still follow tennis?
A little bit, not that much. I used to follow it a lot more when I was young. So like in elementary, middle, and high school, I followed tennis a lot more. I still really enjoy watching like Serena Williams play, Naomi Osaka. When I was younger, I was a humongous fan of Venus Williams. I enjoyed watching Lindsay Davenport. I saw Lindsay Davenport live California at an Indian Wells tournament. I think on the men's side, when I was young, I really loved Pete Sampras play. I just loved watching him play Wimbledon. Was really excited when I was at the University of Cambridge that I was able to go to Wimbledon for one of the quarterfinal days. And was able to watch a few players and see the grounds. As you can kind of see from the names I mentioned, like a lot of the people I watched were sort of from a slightly previous era, like Pete Sampras, Martina Hingis, Lindsay Davenport, Steffi Graf, Andre Agassi. Those players were, I think, the ones that I grew up with. So the ones that I kind of cherish.
That's really great. And apart from tennis, are there any engagements or any other activities that pique your interest and you do as a side or thing to academia now?
I mean, these days I really enjoy hiking. You know, it's during the pandemic, so there aren't so many activities that you can do, but hiking is one of them. Spending time outdoors in nature. I've really enjoyed just kind of being able to go on long hikes and explore sort of beautiful natural settings. So I've really been enjoying that.
That's really great. And is there any aspect? It's been over a year where Zoom has literally taken over our lives and the sense of time has been transient and all. So is there any aspect of academia that you're looking forward to getting back to when we return to normal and whatever normal can be called in these seemingly not normal times and all?
Yeah, I'm very excited to be back in person. I think there's a lot about in-person research collaborations and lab culture that are hard to recreate in the online setting. And it's difficult to put into concrete terms, but I also I'm just very excited to meet members of my lab, most of whom I've not met before, although we've been working together for a year. So it's going to be a lot of fun to actually meet them and to be able to work in person and foster kind of this supportive, inclusive, welcoming environment in a physical place. And also be able to engage in sort of social activities with other people in the lab in person, such as going on hikes together or doing barbecues together and having picnics. Like, I look forward to doing all those things.
And is there any aspect of Zoom school or something of that sort would you like to retain in the post-pandemic world?
Yeah, I definitely think so. So one thing that I've been able to do, because all of our meetings are on Zoom, both my classes and my lab meetings, is to have visitors from other places around the US to call in, 30 minutes here, an hour there, and have conversations with my students about their ongoing research or, thoughts that they have, discussions about papers that they've written. And that kind of connection with folks that I'm not physically close to has been really fantastic to keep in touch with sort of research colleagues that I've not been able to meet because of our inability to have in-person conferences. And also as a way for my students to get to know some of these people where even in an in-person conference, it may be difficult to reach some of these senior academics.
Absolutely. This has been an absolutely riveting conversation with you on your phenomenal journey in academia, science, and life, where you elucidated very beautifully on the multiple things that you have been doing and the very pioneering research that's integral in this post-truth world and a post-pandemic world and all. So thank you for coming and divulging your experience in a random walk. So finally, as a Random Walks podcast tradition, which three people would you like to come and divulge their experience in a random walk of their own?
Which three people I would like to come where on this podcast?
Yeah, on this podcast and divulge their experience just like you did.
Oh gosh, I don't know. It's hard for me to say. I can tell you offline, I guess. I don't know, but it's very vague. I don't know on which topic.
They can be anyone, people who have been affiliated to academia at some point of the time or the other, but they might not necessarily be in academia. They might have moved on to industry. They might have moved on to spirituality or something of that sort. We will be having the head of the Dalai Lama Center at MIT soon, who is also a PhD in physics and all. So that's the thing. So they can be anyone you know in your circles, your mentors, your mentees, anyone.
Yeah, I mean, I think the difficulty is that there's just like too many people to name. I think it would be fantastic to hear more from people in HCI. All of my previous mentors, I think, would be wonderful people to talk to. I think also just younger academics in my field. It's hard for me to name a specific one because honestly, like there are so many of them and they're all really great. it's really difficult for me to just say three names, to be honest. But if you know, if there's a specific topic, I would be able to recommend, I think, lots of people.
That works, and I absolutely understand your predicament, but thank you for coming and divulging experience in a very fascinating random walk.
Yes, thank you. Thanks so much for having me. This is a great conversation.